Former U.S. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin addressed the Economic Club of Indiana on September 19th. It was the first of a series of luncheons in Indianapolis. The former economic advisor to President Clinton talked about a range of topics, including the complex fiscal environment and economic development in the urban sector. First, though, we'll hear from Deborah Daniels, Secretary of the Economic Club of Indiana.
We're really excited about the speakers that we have this year. Our program committee has done a great job of putting together a series of speakers on a variety of topics. As you know, and as this program will reflect, we started off with former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. We're having other national corporate leaders, including Jim Rogers, the CEO of Synergy Corporation. And obviously energy is a huge issue of concern in this country right now, so we look forward to that. Jim Press, just recently, actually when we lined him up, was president of Toyota North America. Since we made these arrangements, he has now moved over to Chrysler, and he's vice chairman and president of Chrysler. So this will be pretty interesting just from the broad automotive industry approach. You know, we're eager to see what kinds of comparisons perhaps he can draw. And, you know, American automakers have a real road ahead of them in competing with the Japanese. So this should be really interesting. And then we have other national leaders and commentators. The president of United Way of America is coming, Brian Gallagher. Steve Hayward of the Pacific Research Institute will be talking about global warming, a huge issue of interest to people in Indiana and throughout the country and the world. Walter Williams is a well-known national commentator and a professor of economics at George Mason will be speaking. He'll be our last speaker of the year next May. And then we always try to have some Indiana-specific speakers. And so this year I think we're hitting a home run because not only do we have the presidents of both universities, the new presidents, so we have Michael McRobbie and we also have Dr. Franz Cordova. It would just be a tremendous opportunity for people to hear statewide what these folks have to say. And then we also have Dr. Eugene White. Dr. White is the superintendent of schools at the Indianapolis Public Schools System, but so much more than that. He's a real innovator. He's a risk taker. He is doing things that are going to make a huge difference in our ability to educate our children in Indianapolis and I think be a leader in Indiana and perhaps the country in that respect. Dr. White, I think, didn't have to do what he has done. He was in a comfortable position as the superintendent of a suburban school system suburban Indianapolis, and he chose to go back to the very difficult environment of the Indianapolis public school system because he cares so much about what happens to our youth. So we just think the world of Dr. White, and we can't wait to hear from him. Each of these speakers brings a great deal to the table and will give all of our listeners, all of our attendees and listeners on public broadcasting throughout the state, a very broad picture of issues facing Indiana and the nation.
Robert Rubin has been one of the nation's leading figures in finance and economic policy development for most of his professional career. After graduating from Harvard, where he received a Bachelor of Arts in Economics, and from Yale, where he obtained a law degree, he's worn several hats: attorney, economist, co-chair and senior partner of Goldman Sachs, director of the National Economic Council, 70th Treasury Secretary of the United States, and a best-selling author on the New York Times list. Mr. Rubin is well known for polite confidence, both on Wall Street and in Washington, D.C. I'm told that when the call came at 2:30 in the morning asking him to accept a multi-million dollar pay cut and serve as head of President-elect Clinton's National Economic Council? He simply replied, I would be delighted, and went back to sleep. As a top Clinton advisor, he directed the economic policy process, was a driving force for deficit reduction, pushed for a more business-friendly health initiative. As Treasury Secretary, he took quick action to stem the financial crisis in Mexico, in Asia, and in Russia, generating appreciation from countless investors. Forbes magazine described him as having a special quality of quiet, cool leadership under fire, and praised his discretion in navigating some of the most contentious issues of our time. Secretary Rubin returned to the private sector as a Citigroup executive in 1999. In addition to continued work at that financial giant, he advocates for economic development in distressed urban and rural areas, an effort he spearheaded during his White House days. Still not one to shy away from important issues, Rubin is regularly quoted as an opinion leader on controversial topics such as tax increases and economic reform. Like each of you, I am looking forward to hearing his comments. Please join me in welcoming Robert Rubin.
Thank you, Jay. It is true that it was 2:30 in the morning. I was in Frankfurt, Germany, asleep. Warren Christopher, who was running the transition, later became Secretary of State, called and said, President-elect Clinton would like you to be chairman of the new National Economic Council. Would you be willing to do it? I said, Chris, I'd be delighted. I went back to sleep. Then I came home, and I told my wife, guess what I just decided to do? We lived in New York. We're going to move to Washington. I'm going to be chairman of the National Economic Council. She said, what? And that began a non-love affair between, not between me and my wife, that was fine, but between my wife and Washington. About three years later, we were in the midst of the debate over lifting, I was by this time at Treasury, we were in the midst of the debate over lifting the debt ceiling, and we had taken some very unusual measures in order to enable the federal government to pay its debt, while some were arguing that we should default on our debt, unless President Clinton were willing to sign a budget he would never have signed. The chairman of the House Rules Committee got up on the floor of the House and said that because of the actions I was taking, he was going to move that I be impeached. So I got home, or home rather, the hotel I lived in, and my wife called. She said, I hear you're going to get impeached. And I said, well, I don't think it's going to happen. I said, why? And she said, I'd like to come and testify for them. So life has its ups and downs, and I guess. Be all that as it may, here we are. First of all, I'm delighted to be here. And I was last year in 1990, when the Democratic National Committee had its midterm meeting here, and they were making a site selection decision with respect to the Democratic National Convention. I was chairman of the New York City Host Committee, and I came here, and we first made our case, and then we begged and groveled and did all the things you do when you want to get something, and they gave it to us. It was a very nice time. I have very fond memories of being here, both because it seemed like a wonderful city and also because we came for. Be all that as it may, I was asked today to discuss my views on the longer-term economic outlook for the American economy. And I'm going to do that from the interrelated perspectives, at least interrelated in my view, of investment and policymaking. What I will do is focus on the issues that I wrestle with every day as I think about my own investment posture and as I think about our nation's policy issues. It may well be that many of you would reach different conclusions, maybe many of you will reach different conclusions about the issues I'll raise. But I don't think that's what's important. What I think is important is, at least in my view, the issues I'll raise do need to be carefully thought through if you're going to make sound judgments in today's extraordinarily complicated environment. I'm also going to briefly touch on the politics around economic issues, because what happens to our economy going forward is going to be enormously affected by how well or how badly our political system addresses our immediate and our longer-term economic challenges. To start, I believe that we are in a time of truly extraordinary complexity and uncertainty with respect to the longer-term outlook for the United States economy, and it's that longer-term outlook that I at least think is the most important for investors. But before turning to that longer-term outlook, let me comment briefly on the current market disruptions, because there's so much on people's minds, and where they might lead. These disruptions, as you know, occurred primarily in the credit markets. They started with subprime mortgages, then they spread elsewhere. They are, in my view, a natural reaction to a lengthy period during which risk was underweighted, underconsidered. Risk, by historic standards at least, was underweighted, underconsidered in the valuation of almost all asset classes in the United States, very importantly, including the terms and pricing of credit extension. And just as an aside, although it's not my point this morning, looking at the stock market, because that's a matter that is always of substantial interest to people involved in investment, valuation ratios have been at relatively normal levels, but total profits as a percentage of the economy have been very high by historic standards. And so the application of normal valuation ratios to extraordinarily high profits may well represent overvaluation unless you believe that these profit levels will stay at these very high levels. In any case, let me expand for a moment on the general phenomenon of market disruptions. Free market financial systems, like we have in the United States, provide enormous benefits to an economy. But they also have a history of seemingly inevitable periodic excess leading to periodic disruption. Today's events are just the latest example. In all of these periodic cycles, first asset prices go ever higher due to a buoyant market psychology. Then the market psychology changes, often for reasons that nobody can really identify. Creditors and investors withdraw from riskier assets and reduce leverage. Asset prices fall and credit tightens. Also, markets have short memories. So within a few years of recovery, new excesses often begin, usually with a story of why this time is different. For investors, and I've been an investor for a long, long time, that inherent cyclicality of markets is a caution to heed when times become heady. For policymakers, that cyclicality does not mean trying to eliminate risk, because to eliminate risk would require restrictions so smothering as to lose the benefits of our free market financial system. Instead, it seems to me, policymakers should try to find the right regulatory balance between allowing our markets to operate freely and creating constraints to reduce systemic risk. Having said that, the most pressing question now is how much effect these current financial disruptions will have on our economy. The greatest risk, as you all know, is the possible impact on consumption and construction due to increasing subprime mortgage defaults, soft housing prices, massive resets on adjustable rate mortgages, tighter credit, and our nation's roughly zero personal savings rate. And, as has so often happened before, if a serious slowdown were to begin, then the factors involved in the slowdown tend to build on themselves. Economic prediction is an uncertain matter at best, and this, in my judgment, is an uncertain time. My own view is that the greater probability is that we will avoid economic difficulty. But, and having said that, the risk of such difficulty has increased, and at least in my judgment, it is substantial enough to be worrisome. In addition to the factors that I've just mentioned that could lead to difficulty, there is always the possibility that the longer-term risk that I'll be discussing shortly could materialize in the near term. My own bottom line, when you tie everything that I'll be discussing today together, has been for some time as an investor that the ratio of reward to risk has probably deteriorated, leading me at least to a cautious investment posture, and that's still a view I hold today. The next question is how best to address the current disruptions in order to limit the potential for economic and social duress. Clearly, the Federal Reserve Board's decisions, I shouldn't say clearly, but at least in my view, the Federal Reserve Board's decisions on interest rates are the single most important area in this regard. The Fed, as we all know, lowered rates yesterday. Markets have reacted exceedingly well. But having said that, there was and still is debate about how much the Fed should do and whether they should have acted sooner. My own view is that these Federal Reserve Board interest rate decisions are extremely complicated. They involve powerful competing considerations. And I believe that the Fed's actions have been well within the boundaries of good sense and sound judgment. In addition, measures to help subprime mortgagees, borrowers, or the mortgage market more generally could be useful both with respect to our economy and to reducing the terrible tragedy of people losing their homes. There are also many proposals focusing not on addressing the immediate disruptions, but rather on improving consumer protection in the mortgage area for the future and on reducing systemic risk in the financial markets. And the policy and political task is to make sound and constructive judgments in response to these proposals. Having now commented on the immediate issues relating to the current market disruptions, let me turn to two key areas of complexity with respect to the longer term, areas that I think are critical to investors and to policymakers. Then I'm going to finish with a brief set of comments, brief discussion, of a remarkably successful ongoing program in community development here in Indianapolis that has important lessons for the rest of the country. The two key areas of complexity that I'll discuss are, one, a transformation that is now underway of historic proportions in the global economy, and two, a juxtaposition in the United States of, on the one hand, great strengths in our own economy and great opportunities from the change taking place in the global economy, and on the other hand, hugely consequential challenges such as our multiple financial imbalances and inadequate public education. These challenges must be met if we're going to realize our potential, and at least in my view, if they are not met, we could have serious difficulty over the longer term. To start with the first of my two areas of complexity, the global economy and the global competitive environment are undergoing the most significant transformation, in my view, since the emergence of the United States over 100 years ago, including rapid and profoundly important technological development, the ever greater integration of trade, investment, and capital markets, although there's currently some threat to that from protectionist pressure around the globe, the spread of market-based economics around the world, the adoption of effective productivity policies in China, India, and elsewhere, and finally, as a result of all this, the emergence of China and India as powerful competitive forces. In addition, as part of this transformation, there is a vast wealth shift to the oil-producing countries and to the Asian countries with their large trade surpluses. Everything I've just said about transformation is widely recognized. But I think very, very few investors and very, very, very few policymakers have truly internalized how profound this transformation and its economic and investment ramifications may be over the years and decades ahead. There is massive change occurring in the realities of the global economy, and all of our investment and policy decisions must recognize that transformational change. In that context, China and India, which are at the core of this global transformation, obviously face their own immensely consequential challenges. And the politics of addressing those challenges will be very difficult, not only in democratic India, but even in more authoritarian China. Thus, it is certainly possible that either or both of those countries could falter. However, I've had the opportunity, as some of you certainly have had, to spend a lot of time with Chinese and Indian private and public sector leaders. And I think the likelihood is high that both countries will continue to move forward on public policy, though perhaps with some ups and downs, and thus continue their high rates of growth. I also believe that non-Japan Asia is highly likely to continue moving forward to becoming the center of the global economy over the years and decades ahead. On that score, let me make two additional comments. Firstly, an external risk to this whole scenario is the possibility, I think unfortunately the real possibility, of increased protectionism around the globe, with the most immediate concern being the possibility of U.S. actions against China. And secondly, today's robust growth in Asia and other emerging market countries could offer support for the U.S. economy in a down cycle, but domestic demand in these countries is still not sufficient for growth to avoid serious adverse effect if our economy were to seriously weaken. To take the discussion of trade a few steps further, the range of tradable goods and services is expanding rapidly, largely because all services that can be electronically communicated can now potentially be produced anywhere in the world and then delivered on a real-time basis in the United States. That doesn't mean that all or even most or even a substantial part of these jobs will move. It simply means that with these new technologies, those jobs could move. There are many advantages with respect to keeping those jobs in the United States: proximity to suppliers, customers, competitors, and colleagues, and the enormous strengths of the American economy. Having said that, the vast increase in this potential, combined with China's and India's enormous capacity and rapidly increasing productivity, could lead to continued pressure on wages and on job dislocation in the United States. Having said that, let me quickly say that the greatest pressure on wages and job insecurity comes not from trade, but from technology. As to trade, there is no question in my mind that trade liberalization has enormously benefited our economy and the great preponderance of our people, and is the best and right path forward for our country. Consumer prices, input prices for producers, inflation, interest rates are all lower due to trade, and we get the benefits of comparative advantage that traditional economics talks about, and American business is under constant pressure to be more efficient and more productive, which is to the benefit of our economy and, again, the great preponderance of all Americans. We cannot and should not attempt to shut ourselves off from the global economy. Looking forward, failure to move ahead on trade would forego the potential for further benefits. Moreover, the rest of the world is going to move forward, whether we do or not. The only question is whether we will be inside the network of preferential trade arrangements or outside. And moving backwards on trade would be even more harmful. Consumer prices would be higher. Our producers would have increased input prices versus foreign competitors. Our exports would be subject to retaliation, and our currency could be disrupted. Having said all that, we must also do a far, far better job addressing the real difficulties that most Americans are facing today and have faced for a long time, with stagnant median real wages, greatly increased inequality favoring a very small tier at the top, and increased job insecurity. Broad participation in our nation's economic growth and increased economic security are absolutely critical objectives of economic policy and for our society, and also are critical with respect to obtaining support for market-based economics and trade liberalization, both of which are so central to the future of our economy. Both Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke have made this second point, saying in various speeches that broad participation in economic growth is critical to growth itself, because the market and trade policy underpinnings of our economy will only have public and therefore political support if the great preponderance of our people believe they will benefit from these policies. To accomplish these broad purposes that Greenspan and Bernanke have set forth, market-based economics and trade liberalization should be accompanied by a powerful domestic agenda, which I'll outline briefly in just a moment. To promote productivity, growth, broad participation in that growth, and, as I said a moment ago, increased economic security. The problem is that the politics of this parallel agenda of trade and domestic policy are very difficult. Too often, those who support trade do not support the domestic agenda, and those who support the domestic agenda do not support trade. Now, let me briefly expand on my secondary complexity, the juxtaposition of strengths and challenges in the American economy. Our economy has enormous strengths, strengths that can enable us to thrive in a transforming global economy. Our cultural embrace of change, our willingness to take risk, our flexible labor markets, our relative openness to trade and immigration, at least so far, and our huge critical mass in many capabilities and markets. On the other hand, as I said earlier, we face immensely consequential challenges, and how our political system responds to those challenges will be central to our economy's economic future. I think of the challenges to government and to public policy, all of which are serious risks, if not effectively addressed, as falling into four baskets. In the interest of time, I'm simply going to list these baskets, not discuss them, except for the first, which I will expand on slightly. Number one, our multiple financial imbalances, which I'll come back to in a moment. Number two, serious shortfalls in the requisites for economic growth that government must meet because markets, by their very nature, will not meet. For example, quality public education, infrastructure, basic research, effective energy policy, an effective health care system, better social safety nets, help for dislocated workers, bringing the poor into the economic mainstream, extremely important economic objective aside from social issues, and much else. Number three, the cost-benefit excesses in our regulatory and litigation regimes. And number four, as I've already discussed in part, sound international economic policy with respect to trade, immigration, flexible exchange rates, response to global financial disruptions when they occur, and other matters. At the same time, we must also address a new generation of national security risks that could severely affect our economy, but are not reflected in markets, except perhaps in the market for oil. These geopolitical risks include nuclear proliferation, which, at least in my view, seems on the brink of a truly dangerous escalation, Islamic radicalism, an oil shock, and much else. To turn to our financial imbalances, they include past and projected fiscal deficits. Instead of the surpluses we could have had and should have had in recent years and going forward, given the surpluses we had at the beginning of the decade, and given what the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has referred to as temporary increases in tax revenues due to high corporate profits, due to a skewing of incomes toward high bracket taxpayers, and due to a strong stock market. Our financial imbalances also include massive projected increases in Social Security and health care entitlements, a de minimis national savings rate of roughly 2% of our economy. China has roughly 45% savings rate. A personal savings rate of approximately zero, a current account or trade deficit of roughly 7% of GDP, which would have been unthinkable in past decades and is about four times the average of the 1990s, and heavy overweighting of dollar-denominated assets in foreign portfolios. Ben Bernanke, in testimony not too long ago, referred to today's fiscal environment as, quote, the calm before the storm, unquote, if, as he said, we do not address these imbalances. But the politics of reestablishing sound fiscal conditions will be brutally difficult. It will require increasing revenue, disciplining spending, and addressing entitlements. And those political difficulties will be even greater because, at least in my view, we must at the same time create budgetary room for additional public investment in areas that are critical to our economy and our society, the kinds of areas I referred to before. The serious adverse effects that these imbalances could have on our currency, our bond market, interest rates, and business and consumer confidence more generally have been avoided so far by vast capital inflows from China and other nations seeking to support the dollar and thereby support their exports, and by vast capital inflows from oil-producing countries seeking to invest in politically stable areas. These inflows certainly could continue for some time, but at least in my view, they almost surely will not go on indefinitely in the face of these imbalances, though the timing is unpredictable. A key to our longer-term outlook, as I said earlier, is how well or how badly our political system will meet our longer-term challenges and our more immediate issues. Many journalists and elected officials who have been around Washington for a long time will tell you, at least in private, that in their view, the willingness of our political system to reach across party lines, to reach across ideological lines, and the willingness in our political system to make politically difficult decisions has deteriorated very substantially over time to very low levels today. It's an issue that Alan Greenspan addresses in his book that came out Monday. My own view is that meaningfully improving this functioning of our political system, without regard to how you allocate blame for the circumstance as between the political parties, is the most fundamental challenge with respect to our future economic well-being and with respect to the future of our nation as a whole. Serious responses to the longer-term challenges that I briefly mentioned will inevitably require politically difficult trade-offs with winners and losers, and often in exchange of current costs for future benefits. The 08 elections could improve the effectiveness of our political system, depending on the mindset of our new leaders, the politics, and the circumstances. But the underlying causes of our system's problems are, in my judgment, far more fundamental and need to be addressed with thoughtfulness and effectiveness. I said earlier that before winding up, I would comment briefly on a discussion of community development in Indianapolis. One of our nation's greatest economic challenges, with enormous potential for reducing social cost and for increasing productivity, is to equip the residents of inner cities to enter the economic mainstream. A prime mover in this effort is the Local Initiative Support Corporation, known as LISC, a nonprofit community development organization which last year distributed over $1 billion to inner cities around the country. I've had the good fortune of chairing LISC since I left Treasury. And the LISC program in Indianapolis, which began in 1992, is one of our outstanding programs and is frequently cited as a model for other cities around the country. A little over 3 years ago, local community leaders met with your mayor, Bart Peterson, to discuss a renewed vision for neighborhood improvement in Indianapolis. Over the next year, the city's leadership came together. Elected officials, neighborhood leaders, business and philanthropic decision makers, to develop a new strategy that could, over time, comprehensively redevelop the neighborhoods of Indianapolis that were most in need. The strategy is called the Great Indy Neighborhoods Initiative. It recognizes that in order to transform neighborhoods, development efforts must include physical spaces, human needs, encourage participation in community life, and promote job creation. And now the Great Indy Neighborhoods Initiative has begun taking hold. And that is due to the vigor of the civic, the political, and the philanthropic leadership of Indianapolis. For the American economy to work for some of us, it must work for all of us, especially in today's highly competitive global environment. And Indianapolis, with its vigorous commitment to community development, is showing the way forward. With this, let me conclude by saying that My remarks have focused largely on the challenges and the risks that we face, both in relation to immediate circumstances and for the longer term. And that's the focus of my remarks because, as I've said a number of times now, how those challenges and risks are addressed will be so central to our country's economic future. But the U.S. economy has enormous strengths, which I discussed a moment ago. Our economy and our country have a history of resilience in rising to address the difficult challenges of the times. And the changes in the global economy present great opportunities for a robust economy like ours. As I said earlier, we can thrive over the longer term in a rapidly changing global environment. But there is much to do. And in that regard, all of us can contribute to meeting the underlying need for a more effective political system by informing ourselves about the key challenges facing our country, and then, as an informed electorate, holding our public officials accountable for making the politically tough decisions that are necessary to meet the challenges before us. Thank you very much.
We have a little time for questions. If you have a question that you would like to address to Mr. Rubin, please jot it down on one of the cards on your tables and either pass or bring that up to the head table. I'm going to start off with a question I was handed, which may be one he's been asked many times. Is deficit reduction best accomplished through economic growth, increased taxation, or reduced spending?
Yes.
It's an essay question.
No, it's a good question. It's a very good question. A very brief answer would be this. The 1990s, we started, President Clinton came into office, there were enormous projected deficits. He said that's the threshold issue. He put aside a number of really important initiatives that he would like to have taken. And what we did was put out a program that depended half on tax increases, half on spending reductions. That then got credibility in the markets. The credibility of the markets resulted in lower interest rates, but even more importantly, I think, in a general restoration of business and consumer confidence. That, in turn, stimulated the economy. The stronger economy then contributed to the deficit reduction, and you've got a virtuous cycle of growth and deficit reduction. So I think it takes all of these things, but then you've got to decide how do you move growth forward, and I think you're not going to have growth over the long term unless you have sound fiscal conditions. And this notion of a free lunch because you can lower taxes, it'll increase growth, and that's enough to pay you back for the loss of revenue from taxes. There is no serious academic support for that position, and there's nothing empirical to support either, as far as I know. No, I'm going to take the "as far as I know" away. There's nothing empirical to support it. I mean, it's a nice idea that you can sort of levitate, but levitation has a tendency to be rather difficult to do.
Do you concur with your friend Alan Greenspan's view about the causes for the Iraq war?
Well, I think the Iraq war is a very complicated situation. I honestly don't know why we went in. I don't even have a personal view as to whether we should have gone in light of the facts as people knew them at the time. I think the only thing you can say is I think it's virtually universal agreement that it hasn't been handled well since we went in. And that has been a great tragedy for the people of Iraq and, of course, for the people of our own country.
Do you think that the budget policies during Clinton's administration would be more effective in the current economic climate?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, all questions are interesting. I don't mean to make one sound better than the other. But I think fiscal discipline is as important now as it was when we got in, albeit for slightly different reasons. When we got in, you had relatively high interest rates. You had relative economic morass. Growth had begun, but a lot of people thought it was going to quickly recede. Business confidence was not at high levels and so forth. And so you had an immediate issue that we could address with our and we thought the only way to effectively address it was with fiscal discipline. At the present time, interest rates are low for all the reasons I mentioned. But the problem is your entitlements are picking up at a very rapid rate. We have an immense trade and current account deficit, and that's partly caused by the fact that we have a very low savings rate. If we increased fiscal discipline and had the surpluses, the baseline here is not balanced. We should be having surpluses right now. We could have had them. So if we had surpluses right now, then your savings rate would be higher, your trade deficit would be lower, and secondly, and very importantly, you'd be better preparing yourself for what is just around the corner, which are this enormous increases in entitlements. And the problem is we're going to have to face this. You can't. There's no long-term free lunch in any of this stuff. And the trouble is now when we have to face it, we're going to have to make much more dramatic adjustments in a short period of time. That can be a serious economic problem. If we had had the surplus we should have had, or if we went back to sound economic policy right now, you could make that adjustment much more slowly. And I think, I don't think any question, actually, and have a much healthier economic environment over time.
My name is Kevin Briniger, and I'm President and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. For many years, the Economic Club of Indianapolis was managed by the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. And but the Economic Club itself has a separate board of directors, and it has been in existence for many years, and serves for the purpose of bringing sort of high-level, many cases national, some cases top state-level speakers to come in and speak and be available to the business community in central Indiana. And about a year and a half ago or so, the Indianapolis Chamber went to the Economic Club Board and said, we don't think we want to continue to serve in this function anymore. So they were looking for someone to manage the club for the board, because the board is a volunteer board and they have other jobs and duties and responsibilities. And the Indiana Chamber does a lot of conferences and seminars and events. We do about 50 regulatory compliance seminars a year. We put on an awards dinner in the fall where we give awards for Community of the Year, Business Leader of the Year, and Government Leader of the Year, and then have a featured speaker. We put forth we're the partner for the Best Places to Work in Indiana program. So we have a lot of experience and expertise on staff at putting on events, and we have, in fact, four certified meeting planners. So it's something we do and do very well. So we thought this would be a good fit. But because we are the Indiana Chamber, we talked to the board about making it and sort of transforming the club into the Economic Club of Indiana, with the idea that over time we may take some of the lunches. Right now, the club kind of follows the school year calendar, where they have lunches once a month for 9 months, and then they tend to take the summers off. So we're discussing some ideas with them to make it a more statewide focus by perhaps going out state away from Indianapolis in the summer months when the club doesn't traditionally meet, possibly setting up teleconferencing, video conferencing sites so that even when we have an event, a luncheon in Indianapolis, perhaps that would be broadcast with two-way audio and video to sites in different places around the state, so you could go in, watch the club, and then even ask questions and go back and forth. So those are some things we're kicking around. Nothing's been decided yet, but that would be, we think, a way to make this the Economic Club of Indiana, as opposed to its traditional focus just on Indianapolis and the central Indiana. The benefits of belonging to the Economic Club of Indiana is, one, you get discount tickets on the luncheons. You receive information about the club events, and you know in advance the whole, you know, we have a brochure that shows the speakers for the entire year. You get advantages as far as table locations and table selections, and there are many sponsorship opportunities, so there's a lot of potential visibility for your company if you were to become a member of the Economic Club and then choose to be a sponsor. It's a great program. I look forward to it every month. The speakers are always very informative and very thought-provoking, and it's something that the Indiana Chamber of Commerce is very pleased to be involved with. I'm looking forward to hearing from the two new presidents of IU and Purdue. I think Jim Rogers, you know, has some roots in Indiana. He's the October speaker. Then he's moved on to become head of Duke Energy, and I think energy is a big issue for our state. We haven't built any new baseload capacity for electricity in Indiana for about 25 years. So we're facing a point in time where our ability to provide for electricity in Indiana is becoming a bit challenged, and how we do that I think is going to be very important. We have a 500-year supply of coal, but we need to find a way to utilize that coal but still meet federal air quality standards. We have an opportunity with respect to ethanol and perhaps moving to the next generation of ethanol called cellulosic ethanol, where you're using switchgrass and other biomass instead of corn, so that you get away from the current situation we have now, where the people that feed livestock and use corn for other purposes are now competing with the ethanol plants for the corn supply, and it's driving corn prices up and having some impact on food prices and other commodities that integrate corn into them. So I think Jim Rogers' perspective on energy issues, both in Indiana, where they operate and provide electricity for a large part of our state, as well as nationally. And I know his company and others are starting to branch out into renewable energy sources, or what people refer to as green power. Even here in Indianapolis, you've got you can choose to have that provided from alternative sources. Unfortunately, it's more expensive right now, and in Indiana, we're limited on what types of alternative sources we could use. I mean, we don't have, mountains with big rivers that, could produce hydroelectric power. We're one of the least windy states in the country. There's only a few counties in the state where wind power, at least based on today's technology, is even remotely feasible. And the part of the problem is that even with something like that, when you have sort of an unreliable source, then you still have to have that baseload capacity, and it ends up being, much more expensive to provide than people, are concerned and complain about, how much it costs. For example, people say, oh, let's go wind power, but, we have a lot of 95-degree no-wind days, and people are still going to want their air conditioners to work, so which means you've got to have the baseload power in addition to the renewable power, and now you're duplicating and making it more expensive. So those are tough issues to work through and make policy decisions around. Will be interesting. And then I'm anxious to hear about from Dr. Eugene White of Indianapolis Public Schools, our superintendent of still our state's largest school corporation. I appreciate the efforts that he's making. In certainly a challenging situation where dropout rates are high and parental support isn't what it is in other places, and addressing some things as far as attendance and focusing on graduation rates and the partnership with the local chamber, I think is outstanding, and as well as trying to put less emphasis on who has what by kind of having a standardized set of clothing and uniforms that students wear to school, so that they can focus on learning and be less focused about I'd like to have those shoes. Or I guess one thing I would say is that the folks who serve on the board and have been affiliated with the board for many, many years, and currently led very aptly, ably by Deborah Daniels. But what I've observed in the year and a half or so that we've been involved with the club is that those folks are extremely dedicated to the club and putting on a program series that is outstanding, that brings a diverse array of high-caliber, high-quality speakers, and they are very committed to the club itself and to the mission and the focus of the club for the benefit of the community, both the business community and the not-for-profit community and the others that come to hear the speakers and to be enlightened by the speakers and their message.
You've been listening to the Indiana Public Broadcasting series of the Economic Club of Indiana. The guest speaker was Robert Rubin. The former U.S. Treasury Secretary served as an assistant to President Clinton on economic policy. On October 31st, the club welcomes CEO of Duke Energy, Jim Rogers. Luncheons begin at noon and are held at the Indianapolis Convention Center. For more information, please visit IndyEconClub.org. Thanks for listening. Thank you.